This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are forests releasing their carbon wealth to the sky? Should we fear a new burst of warming and extreme weather due to record wildfires? I'll ask atmospheric scientist John C. Lynn from Utah. From the UK, Dr. Edward Hanna tells us why unusual air pressure over Greenland can ruin European summers and pump up sea levels. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where reality comes out through science. In 2018, vast plumes of smoke erupted into the atmosphere from very large wildfires on a couple of continents. Will that make global warming worse? I've called Professor John C. Lynn from the Land-Atmosphere Interactions Research Group at the University of Utah. After studying and teaching in Canada, John Lynn got his doctorate in Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard. He is widely involved in the scientific community, including his role as a science team member with NASA. And Lynn is author or co-author of 10 peer-reviewed papers published just so far in 2018 alone. From Salt Lake City, Professor Lynn, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it's a joy to join you today.
All right, so I'm hoping to get an atmospheric view of this wildfire story. What happens when a large forest apparently vaporizes into the air?
A lot happens. We're all probably familiar with what happens on the ground. The various parts of the vegetation burn up or almost disappear, leaving a very charred landscape behind. But also a lot happens in the atmosphere. So different things get released into the atmosphere. So that includes the different aerosols that we call the particles that make it to the atmosphere. There's also various, I would say, pollutants that affect human health. There's also, of course, the greenhouse gases. The carbon that was stored in the form of wood and leaves in the vegetation get vaporized and they get turned into carbon dioxide. So that is a greenhouse gas that I'm sure you've talked many times in your program.
And this year in the journal Atmosphere, you and your colleagues published a paper about the difficulties of modeling forest fire smoke. What is the problem?
Well, the forest fires themselves generate heat, and that causes the atmosphere around the fires itself to change. So that causes sometimes pretty extreme what we call pyrocumulus clouds, that clouds that extend very high into the atmosphere. And that is often very difficult to model. So that's one example. Another way to think about it is the fires create its own weather. And that could affect exactly how far downwind the smoke plume reaches.
Well, I know when volcanoes erupt or even when nuclear reactors blow up, we know that a key factor is whether the particles and gases manage to rise as high as the stratosphere. John, why is that important?
Absolutely, yeah. The stratosphere, which is the layer of atmosphere above the lowest part of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere, so that layer is more stable. So if the particles from fires or volcanoes make it up to the stratosphere, they can hang around for a while. So there are famous examples like after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, where the aerosols hung around for a year or two, and that caused a global cooling effect. So that is one of those very dramatic global phenomena that persisted for a year or two, but eventually these particles do go away. And we're back.
Do you know if that happened in this fire season this year?
I'm not aware of huge amounts of aerosols making it to the stratosphere from the fires. Those huge events from the fires are more on the rare side. So typically the smoke does still stay within the troposphere. So then they dissipate relatively quickly.
But this past summer, even in the troposphere, the smoke from the giant wildfires in Siberia was reported to have blown 5,000 miles across Canada as far as New England. Does that strike you as unusual transport in the atmosphere?
So those do happen, and that happens even if it doesn't make it into the stratosphere. What you're describing is sort of long-range transport across the Pacific does happen even if the plume makes it only in the upper part of the troposphere. So maybe, I would say, over 10 kilometers above sea level. So that can still happen without making it all the way to the stratosphere.
And where does the ash and soot from wildfires in the northern hemisphere tend to end up? Do we know?
Were you thinking about fires, say, from Canada or?
Yes, Canada and the boreal or in Siberia. Does it all go up to the Arctic and blacken glaciers and ice there or not?
That does happen, but plenty stay at lower latitudes as well. In fact, there's some emergent sort of research from different groups looking at long-term trends of these kind of particles, and there appear to be an increasing trend in these extreme events in the western U.S., for example, most likely due to fire. So there's a very likely scenario of increasing sort of fire activity, large, intensive fires happening. I know B.C. was kind of a record year this year, right? I think it's, isn't it the sort of the most amount of burned area?
Yes, it either is this year or it tied with last year.
Yeah, these 2 years are quite pronounced, yeah.
We've had fire emergencies both years, and I personally, as my listeners are tired of hearing about, was smoked out for a couple of weeks, and we had fires right up on the hill above our house and so on. But anyway, you did mention a lot goes on when these fires happen, and I wanted to just touch on a couple of the lesser-known gases. I know that wildfires produce a lot of carbon monoxide. I've seen NASA maps showing huge spots of carbon monoxide. There was one right here in British Columbia during our fire emergency last summer. How long does carbon monoxide last in the atmosphere?
Carbon monoxide, or CO as we call it, lasts on the order of a month. Depends on the season, but I would say a good rule of thumb is about a month. So it's not, I would say, super long-lived compared to some other gases, but it does hang around for a bit. Mainly it gets oxidized to CO2 eventually.
So can carbon monoxide also affect the climate?
In the sense that it eventually shows up as carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we are talking about. Yeah, so in the form of carbon monoxide or eventually CO2, the fires definitely produce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that is definitely a warming effect that one should think about from the fires. And perhaps this is a good time maybe to talk about your original question, what is the sort of net effect potentially of fires, warming or cooling? And that's where the discussion gets more complicated, because while the fires release a fair bit of greenhouse gas, they also have other effects. It depends on the time scale you're talking about. So it affects the landscape, the forests. Sometimes take quite a while to grow back after the fire. So then the question is, what happens to the landscape that it leaves behind? And perhaps surprisingly to some people, it could have a cooling effect. And that actually happens in some of the more northern latitudes, like in Canada, because the forests actually are less reflective than the landscape that they leave behind after they burn up. So there could paradoxically be almost a cooling effect from that perspective. So there are these competing effects from the greenhouse gases to the more reflective landscape that it leaves behind. So that's where careful calculations have to be done.
And what about the dimming effect from the smoke itself? I mean, it was cold here when it was densely packed with smoke.
So definitely there is a cooling effect perhaps right in the vicinity of the fire. The smoke can really block out the sun, yeah? So there's sort of a local cooling effect that would dissipate after a while as well. So that cooling effect wouldn't necessarily last. So the IPCC has done some careful calculations of the net effect of these aerosols that the fires emit. And there's sort of, it's kind of a cancellation. There's some cooling, but also some warming. And the last IPCC report arrived at what they call radiative forcing of roughly zero. So those are washing up. But the other effect I'm talking about, this albedo effect, the reflectivity of the ground, that can persist for a while because, as I said, the vegetation takes a while to grow back. And if we're thinking about the more northern latitudes, the formerly darkened surface would be turned into a reflective surface, especially if there's snow on the ground. So that's where perhaps you can see where this cooling can come from.
And another idea I've had, which is very unscientific, and I'm hoping you can help me out with it, is whether, I mean, we have a burst of carbon coming out of these fires as the tree trunks release all their carbon and goes into the air. Now, when that carbon arrives in the air, do we have an immediate heating effect like a greenhouse effect, or does it take time for that to really happen?
Are you saying the carbon dioxide, does that immediately get to work in terms of trapping infrared radiation? Is that where we're getting at?
Yeah,
so that can take place pretty quickly, but we're well aware of the fact that that burst of carbon dioxide gets mixed really rapidly. So carbon dioxide is often referred to as well-mixed greenhouse gas. So while it's true that, let's say, in downtown Vancouver or right downwind of a fire, the carbon dioxide would be elevated, that relative increase is not that big compared to the background amount. So while it's true that it would get to work, but that effect is not that big. Yeah, so that net heating. But the aerosols, that cooling effect that you felt, I think you talked about, that could be felt pretty locally, very quickly. But that additional warming from the carbon dioxide is not that pronounced.
Well, thank you. That helps.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor John C. Lin from the University of Utah. We're talking about wildfires, the atmosphere, and climate change. So in 2009, the respected Tasmanian fire scientist David Bauman published a paper where he estimated that fires of all kinds, including agricultural burning, produced greenhouse gases equivalent to 50% of human emissions. But other sources tell me that relatively low carbon contribution from wildfires in the U.S. compared to overall emissions. John, does carbon released from wildfires really matter compared to our fossil fuel burning?
Absolutely. If you're thinking about a global scale, and again, it depends on where you are. Let me go to some of the big fire releases. Indonesia is an example. So the amount of, I think, carbon dioxide released in the recent El Nino event, which was a huge one, the 2015-2016 event from Indonesia, was really big. I think there was a study that showed it rivaled some of the biggest fossil fuel emitting nations in the world just from fires alone from Indonesia. So that was quite a big event. So it does matter in the global sense. There are very big releases of carbon from wildfires. And these days, the biggest are in the tropics, like Indonesia or in the Congo in Brazil, for example, around the Amazon forest. So while they may not be as big in total as the total, let's say, combustion from coal or gasoline or natural gas, wildfire release is still very big. It's the same order of magnitude.
I was surprised when looking into this to find out how much of the planet does burn from time to time. A 2008 study of fires led by a Spanish scientist named Emilio Chuvieco, I hope I pronounced that correctly, found more than 30% of the global land surface has a significant fire frequency. So, I mean, almost a third of the planet burns from time to time. That must add a lot of urgency to the work that you and other atmospheric scientists are doing to track what this really means.
Yes, and this year was a big fire year in the western U.S., and as we just discussed, in British Columbia as well. The western U.S., I should now say western North America, is undergoing a fair bit of change, I think. And I should add that intersects with other sort of effects of climate change. And one big one is the insect damage that's affecting the forests of western North America. The beetle kills leaves a lot of fuel that can lead to catastrophic fires. And you add on top of that human suppression of wildfires over decades, and that leads to a lot of fuel sort of buildup. So even from the perspective of just safety and air quality, wildfires have a big impact. So that is not necessarily climate per se, but it certainly intersects with all the other consequences of climate change.
Well, let's talk about some of your other work. And on each Radio EcoShock show, we try to dive into the deep end at least once and maybe drown. So you are the editor of a book on Lagrangian modeling of the atmosphere. Who is Joseph-Louis Lagrange, and why are you specializing in this work developed in Prussia in the 1700s?
Well, it's Mr. Lagrange, but he's a smart guy, so his name shows up in a lot of things. So this Lagrangian book that I was involved in, and that we make heavy use of, is talking about specific kind of modeling of the atmosphere. And the way it works is there are two basic kinds of modeling that takes place in the atmosphere. One is called Eulerian, named after another famous guy, Euler. And the way that works is you stay stationary, you observe and try to model the atmosphere as it passes you. The other is you go along with the flow in the atmosphere, and that's the Lagrangian kind of modeling that I'm involved in with a lot. And that kind of model can be used to trace wildfires, today's topic. It could be used to trace plumes of pollution and nuclear accidents, all sorts of stuff. So it's been a very, very useful way to understand the atmosphere. One interesting sort of perspective that my group has taken is to do the atmospheric modeling backward in time and try to trace where the air that we measure comes from. So that becomes really useful. Let's say we want to understand where the smoke that we breathe, let's say in Vancouver, comes from. So we trace the air backward in time using the Lagrangian method. We can map out specific parts of the landscape that contribute to that pollution. So that's the kind of application of the Lagrangian modeling.
Yes, we found that we got some dust from eastern China by that kind of research, I think.
Yeah. It's very widely used now, those kind of models.
And I've also noticed, John, that some of the work published by you and your research group is local. It's about Utah. And I'm wondering, maybe that's where the new climate science is going, that we need less now about these grand global averages and more of a focus on the direct impacts where we are.
Yeah, I think that's been perhaps a bright spot, even in the policy realm as well. So as we all know, the federal action on climate in the U.S. has been
pathetic,
kind of quiet in recent years. But there's been a lot of action on the grassroots level, at the local municipal level as well. Lots of cities in North America and beyond around the world have very ambitious, say, climate mitigation plans. A lot of cities, let me just take Salt Lake City example, have very ambitious plans. Salt Lake City is trying to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 80% in a few decades. So 80%, that's a very ambitious plan. So that's where this local research can hopefully help inform and assess different means to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just as a really basic example, we're measuring carbon dioxide around the city of Salt Lake City. It's actually one of the longest-running urban CO2 monitoring networks in the world. So from that perspective, we can measure from the atmosphere how much carbon dioxide is being pumped into Salt Lake City's atmosphere. And we can see how it's changing over time. And if cities have sort of very ambitious plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then we should be able to measure it in the atmosphere. So that's kind of a, I think, exciting new front in the climate research, becoming quite local and potentially engaging the stakeholders and policymakers as well. And once we're talking about, say, city scale, there's a lot of opportunity to engage the public or different people, because we all understand different parts of the city, and that's where we can also tie in with sort of people's individual efforts to try to help.
Have we reached the point yet where any of our listeners can look up how much CO2 is coming from their city?
It's getting there, and there are some nice websites I can share with you. I can dig it up and email it to you at some point. There are some estimates of different cities' emissions. And I believe where you're at, Vancouver, is also, there's a fair bit of work done on that front. Some people at University of British Columbia that I know have done similar kinds of work. So, yeah, it's sort of a growing field. There's a fair bit of action on the urban front. There's hope that this is where the research and the public and the different stakeholders can really meet.
Well, great. If you'd send me those links, I'll put them in my show blog. And I'm also going to look into see whether Europe is doing the same thing. There's a lot of work that could come from that and some activism, as you say. Now, John, when I talk with scientists in various fields, I'm beginning to sense a kind of race developing. And that race is between greenhouse gases produced directly by us humans versus a whole collection of carbon sources and feedbacks coming directly from nature. Right now, we're the biggest polluter, but do you think nature could take over as the major engine of further warming?
I really hope not, because we're already pumping a lot of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So there are some worries. There are some big stores of carbon, for example, that could be destabilized as climate change occurs. Examples include the tropical rainforest, the Amazon, for example, lots of carbon there. There are some climate models that do predict as the climate warms, it could also get drier in the Amazon. And there are some climate models that simulate catastrophic kind of collapse of the Amazon rainforest, which means all that carbon is going to be released to the atmosphere. So that those are really cases where the natural emissions could potentially rival those of the humans. I hope not. There's also the carbon that are found in the permafrost or peatlands in Canada, let's say. If those do melt and dry out, that could also be a big pulse of carbon to the atmosphere. So, yeah, so the potential is there. I'm hoping we don't get there. But I think you're right. There's sort of a general concern. Sometimes it's referred to as tipping points, where you have very large changes that could happen. Still sort of instigated by the human release, but where the natural could have a big response to that.
John, do you think it's fair to say the atmosphere is more complex and fragile than we knew?
It's definitely more complex. I might shy away from fragile, but it's complex, and it responds in ways that could be surprising. And clouds, for example, is another great example. I believe you just talked to my colleague, Tim Garrett, right?
That's right, yes.
And the clouds are a perfect example. There's lots of things that affect clouds, and whether clouds are warm or cool or increase in extent or decrease depends a whole host of variables, including wildfires, which could affect clouds. So it is definitely very complicated, but it makes it interesting as well.
And there's rivers of air up there. I just watched a video from University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith, and he was showing this Beaufort Sea gyre both in the atmosphere, but then that starts to spin the sea below it. So there's a real interaction, and I think your team name shows that, between both the earth and the air, but also the sea and the air.
Oh, yes. And my colleague here, Thomas Reichler, also shows the coupling between the stratosphere and these lower layers. So these layers are seem somewhat separate, but they can be coupled, and that makes it even more complicated and interesting.
And as we finish up here, what are some of the other things you're working on these days?
One thing I'm working on is dust. So I would like to understand the transport and the origins of dust, again, using these Lagrangian models we talked about. But there's a fair bit of concern about a dust transport in the western U.S., and some of that is due to some of the lakes potentially drying up. We have a big one next door called the Great Salt Lake, and right now the aerial extent of the Great Salt Lake is quite low. And that's a combination of human use of water that flows into the lake and also climate change, and that could expose lake beds that could have dust emissions to the atmosphere. And then the dust in the atmosphere, once it's deposited on snow, we're finding out could melt it at a faster rate. And that could be a feedback loop as well. So that's been one other project that I've been working on right now. And another project I'm working on is the use of satellites to determine the carbon emissions from cities from around the world. So NASA has a satellite called OCO2, Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, that's orbiting the Earth, measuring carbon dioxide from around the world. So we're trying to make use of that to figure out how much emissions are happening in different parts of the world. And pretty soon, next year, NASA will be launching OCO3, which will be on the International Space Station. And that will be pretty exciting because that sensor is somewhat different. It'll be able to look at individual cities in detail and really tell us much more about what different cities are emitting.
From the University of Utah, we've been speaking with John C. Lynn, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences. I'll put links to John's webpage and some key papers we've discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. With 18 peer-reviewed papers out this year and more in press, John, are you the kind of person who eats lunch in your office?
Uh-oh, how did you guess? I do.
Well, thank you for spending your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a joy.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What can steer a hurricane into New York City, drive rotten wet summers in the UK and Northern Europe, and change sea level around the world? Here's a hint. It is something you cannot see happening in a place that never appears on your network news weather map. The answer to the question, and more, arrives in our interview with Dr. Edward Hanna, Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology at the University of Lincoln. From the Cathedral City of Lincoln in North England, Dr. Hanna, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, frankly, at first glance, I thought your new paper might be outside the interest of a general audience. The title sounds very science-oriented, but there are at least six very large developments almost hidden in this work. What got you looking at the atmosphere over Greenland, and what is blocking?
So I've been working on Greenland climate and ice glaciology matters for about the last 20 years or so. Initially, actually mainly on looking at changes in the balance of its ice sheet, so consequences for sea level rise and so on, but also with respect to its climate as well, because obviously the two factors are quite closely linked. So it's something I've been working on and quite passionate about for a number of years now, and certainly we've seen some big changes recently. In terms of blocking, well, this is essentially a high pressure that sticks around a certain part of the Earth's surface for a number of days or even up to a few weeks or so. So it's high air pressure or atmospheric pressure that you would typically measure with a barometer at Earth's surface. Not always, but typically we're looking at data near Earth's surface. And the whole whole point of the blocking is that it will actually can disrupt the normal air circulation in the atmosphere. So where you've got jet stream, for example, then that can get diverted or weakened by these kind of blocking conditions.
So if we have a barometer at home, what is high pressure or low pressure actually measuring?
You're measuring the column of atmospheric mass above where you're measuring that air pressure, and that's really reflecting circulation conditions and changes in the general atmosphere, not necessarily just obviously above the point where you're measuring. Essentially, where you've got higher pressure, this is linked with subsiding air near the surface, so you've got a denser mass of air near the surface. It tends to be, on average, more stable weather conditions. Low pressure is the measure of the surface. It is more typically linked with very disturbed weather conditions and things like cyclones that are commonly associated with the jet stream.
Well, Greenland's pretty far away from us. Why is atmospheric pressure over Greenland so influential on weather in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, it's quite interesting because we have the jet stream over the North Atlantic area that includes Greenland. Normally, the jet stream flows south of Greenland, but when you have what we call blocking or high pressure developing over Greenland, this can interact with the jet and push it further south. Sometimes it can actually bifurcate the jet, so it sometimes actually passes north over Greenland as well. But it's like a giant stone in a river. When you have this blocking conditions over Greenland, it can actually divert the airflow over much larger regions over the North Atlantic. So it does have consequences well beyond the island itself.
Well, we're all aware that under pressure from advancing climate change, scientists around the world are contributing to very complex models. And one of the holy grails of that whole process was to move from prediction about a global mean or average to advising governments about regional trends that will come up, say, in the next decade or so. What did those modelers miss?
So I think in terms of climate models, they work really well at the global level and even down to a continent scale level. The issue is when you're looking at regional phenomena processes that are operating at subcontinental or smaller scales, and this can include blocking over still quite large areas like Greenland, as well as things like the jet stream, that actually the jet's an incredibly narrow feature quite often, just a few tens of kilometres wide in its main core, that the models can have problems actually capturing some of these smaller scale features in terms of their characteristics and how they vary. So I think if you're looking at any one place on the Earth's surface, obviously it's local weather that we experience in terms of climate change. Depending on where you are, if you're near one of these regional features that's not well represented by the models, then you've got a bit of a problem in predicting the more local scale aspects, if you like, of future climate change. So I think the models are great for the large scale, but somewhat more problematic for the local to regional scale in certain, quite often, key regions.
And it seems to me that your paper finds that what the scientists have been predicting would happen for atmospheric pressure over Greenland is almost the opposite of what observations really show is happening.
Yes, so the models have actually air pressure not changing very much or slightly weakening over the, you can run the models backwards in time for the last 50 years or so, which we've looked at data from such runs of the models retrospectively, but also obviously forward, so forecasts or predictions of the models for the rest of this century. Now, these show a greater reduction in air pressure or blocking over Greenland. What we've seen from the observations for the last 30 years, so since about the 1980s or so, certainly since 1990, is a very strong and significant increase in air pressure over the Greenland region in summer, I should emphasize, not really in the other seasons. So there's been greatly enhanced blocking over Greenland in summer. And if you look at the historic data from the models, that does not show up at all in the climate models.
So if we look at the impact of global warming on the jet stream, which you've discussed a little bit so far, what else have you found in relation to Greenland? What happens with the jet stream?
What happens is that as you have more or increased blocking over Greenland in summer, this tends on average, not all the time, but more often to push the jet stream further south over the North Atlantic region. And also at times that jet stream can weaken as well. So that then affects other regions further south of Greenland, such as the UK. But again, it's the point that blocking over Greenland is not an isolated phenomenon, but it also can affect things like the jet stream and other aspects of climate regionally downstream of Greenland that then affects extreme weather conditions and potentially climate change over those more southerly latitudes.
But the jet stream could be weakening due to other causes, such as disappearing summer sea ice, a connection observed by Jennifer Francis of Rutgers and others. True?
Yes, I mean, certainly we've seen big changes over the Arctic region recently, and I do believe, I mean, there's a number of studies done that suggest that Arctic sea ice reduction, very dramatic in summer in the last 10, 20 years, and the changes that we've been discussing over Greenland are kind of not independent of each other. And you're perfectly right that there's a number of driving influences on the jet stream, including potentially these large Arctic sea ice reductions that could also potentially weaken the jet stream. Now, that is a somewhat still controversial area in climate science. There seems to be some fair evidence from observations that this may be happening, but it needs a lot more further work. But of course, then there's actually a lot of other factors affecting the jet stream as well.
So in the news, I hear about Greenland blocking in storms like Hurricane Sandy. It seemed that hurricane was forced to make a left turn into New York City because of a blocking pattern further north. And in fact, the American Meteorological Society has announced a presentation on just that. The title is A Climatological Assessment of Greenland Blocking During Hurricane Sandy and Its Influence on North Atlantic Hurricane Tracks. How could invisible changes to the atmosphere over Greenland affect weather in the eastern United States?
Well, when you have increased high pressure or blocking sticking around for longer over Greenland, this tends to divert the jet stream near the eastern U.S., so in the western part of the North Atlantic, from what's normally a west-to-east pattern. I mean, it never moves entirely in a straight line, but then it's much more moving from south to north. When these hurricane systems get caught up in the jet stream flow as they move further north from the Caribbean or wherever they initially form, then they get caught up in that airflow, and instead of recurving out eastwards over the North Atlantic, they can actually end up being forced the opposite way. I mean, this was a very special event, but it does certainly seems plausible that with these large-scale changes in the jet stream, it will affect some of the extreme weather events, such as what you mentioned. So I think that's entirely plausible. And also, there's been some previous studies published on the Sandy case study by some pretty reputable Greenland climate scientists as well. So that's actually really interesting.
So it seems your research suggests that predictions for the future weather in the UK and Europe may be incorrect because they don't include this factor of atmosphere over Greenland, correct?
Well, certainly it's a distinct possibility. I must say that we cannot, of course, be sure about this because there is a lot of natural variability in the climate system. So we cannot discount the possibility that the disagreeing trends, if you like, between in blocking over Greenland between the climate models and observations may be a shorter-term blip. But I certainly think that 30 years is a sufficiently long time to flag this quite major discrepancy that potentially that could carry on. And in that case, I think there are serious issues with some of the climate predictions at the more regional level over parts of Northwest Europe.
With those changes over Greenland, Edward Hanna, is it more likely the UK will experience more wet summers as you endured in 2007 and 2012?
I certainly think this is a distinct possibility again, although you wouldn't expect this every summer. And in fact, the summer just passed, so 2018 has been a record warm and dry summer over large parts of the UK. But I'd just like to point out that in the last 100 years, 2007 and 2012, were two of the wettest summers in England and Wales. And I do think that is not unrelated to the increase we've seen in Greenland blocking. What happens is that as the jet moves further south, over the North Atlantic, it normally actually misses most of the UK in the summer, except for a bit near the Scotland. But it's actually come further south and in those 2 years. So it's actually caused a lot of incessant rain-bearing systems to form and pass over England and Wales in 2007 and 2012.
Well, let's say England moves from three and such washouts, summer washouts, in 100 years to 20, that would make a huge difference in the tourism industry, and maybe even agriculture in Northern Europe could be affected.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also got to do with the potentially increased variability if we have more variable conditions, which are also incidentally really hard to predict still in summer compared with winter. I mean, there'd be other industries, food production, agriculture. I mean, I've been looking at wheat yield productions, and we could certainly see more significant drops in those if we have more record wet summers. So that's quite interesting as well.
Do we actually have enough now, though, to change long-term weather trends for Northern Europe, or do we just still need to learn a lot more in this rather amorphous prediction of future weather?
I think there is scope for improving the long-range forecast. So that's something that I'm currently working with other people, both here in Lincoln and elsewhere as well, on currently. I think that in terms of decadal predictions, so for the next, say, 1 to 2 decades, I think we do need to understand more about whether this increase in Greenland blocking, how significant that is in terms of whether it's likely to be sustained. If it is, then I think we do need to revisit some of the regional model predictions of climate change at the country or smaller level for parts of Northern Europe, because the whole point is that if we have even more or increased blocking over Greenland in future or more often, then I think we will expect these more rain-bearing systems, not just over the UK, but some neighbouring parts of Northwest Europe as well.
If we grab a selection of some of the best climate models right now, can we predict the future of climate changes over Greenland itself?
From the current models, and I think this is fairly evident when we look at the IPCC level predictions, there's a huge range of projections, which is even perhaps slightly larger over Greenland than globally. I do feel that model predictions for Greenland of its regional climate, so the warming for the rest of this century, may potentially underestimate the future change if the models, as it seems, may not properly include this sort of blocking phenomenon in within them. So I think there certainly is potential that we're underestimating future warming in Greenland. We can't tell for sure, but we think this merits further work.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me is Professor Edward Hanna, a specialist in climate science and meteorology at Britain's University of Lincoln. We're talking about how climate change and air pressure over Greenland can change many things in this world. So what does atmospheric pressure over the continent of Greenland have to do with the rate and amount of melting on the surface of that frozen continent?
So if you have more high pressure or blocking conditions over Greenland, as I pointed out before, this can divert the jet stream, drag warmer air further north up over the ice sheet, which will cause more surface melting of the ice, and so you'll have more mass being lost from the ice sheet each year and contributing to global sea level rise ultimately. And there's also weather conditions that are linked in with that extra high pressure over Greenland, which may mean clearer skies quite often in summer. So you can have more radiation or energy from the sun actually melting surface ice and snow. So I think you'd expect increased melting and increased loss of mass from the ice sheets.
Okay, now we know that GRACE satellites going over Greenland tell us that the continent is rapidly losing mass as the ice melts. And here's an oddball question from a non-scientist. Does a change in the mass of a continent have any effect on the mass of the atmosphere above it?
I certainly think there can be some small-scale effect. It's not something that I'm directly looking into myself, but I think I've certainly been looking quite closely at the GRACE data, and the interesting thing there is that we've got an accelerating loss of mass from Greenland over the last 20 years. It's something like 250 billion tonnes per year of net mass loss from Greenland. Although it's very dangerous to project trends into the future, that's really highlighting the increase in contribution to sea level that Greenland's recently made.
So how does sea level rise connect with your new research about Greenland?
Well, if we have as we've observed, increased high pressure over Greenland, more blocking in the last few decades, then we think that that has contributed to increased melting, mass loss of the ice sheet, and therefore it's likely to exacerbate sea level rise, and may already have been doing so, in fact. So currently sea level is rising at about 3.5 millimetres per year. Greenland is contributing perhaps two-thirds of a millimetre per year, possibly a bit more, but certainly possible that that will keep increasing slightly, although it's very uncertain with how the solid ice parts of Greenland respond to increased warming. So basically there's a significant contribution from Greenland. It could have been enhanced through these climatological changes that we've been speaking about.
I've been speaking with at least a dozen other scientists who presume a higher sea level rise than projected by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Would you care, Edward, to enter that guessing game? How high do you think the seas might rise by the year 2100?
Well, I mean, I think there's obviously many uncertainties, but we're already seeing significant sea level rise globally. I mean, although it's nearer the top-end projections, I mean, 1 metre by 2100 compared with recent values seems a distinct possibility. And we can't discount the possibility that we could get somewhat more than that. Although, as I say, I think these are upper-end projections. I mean, people have been talking about 1.5 metres. It's unlikely, in my opinion, to be much more than that. But there's still a lot of things that we don't understand. So certainly I think the IPCC estimates of sea level rise for the rest of this century, at least the ones that were published a few years ago, are possibly somewhat conservative compared with what we might actually witness during the rest of this century.
Well, I try to squeeze in at least one science nerd question per interview, and here's this one. What is the North Atlantic Oscillation, and how does that relate to atmospheric pressure over Greenland?
So the North Atlantic Oscillation is basically measuring a difference in air pressure north-south, or south-north, rather, across the North Atlantic. So imagine you had two barometers. One is in the Azores Islands in the middle of the North Atlantic, off the coast, some hundreds of kilometres off the coast of Portugal, and you have another barometer in Iceland, and you're measuring air pressure from both of them at the surface, and you're taking the difference of the Azores minus Iceland. So that pressure gradient is really giving you an idea of how active the jet stream is across the North Atlantic. So when the jet stream is more active, you've got a larger difference between the Azores and Iceland, and the reverse is also true. So basically, this is really a kind of an approximation of jet stream and the strength of the westerly winds across the North Atlantic. Now, the point is that when the jet stream is stronger, so when you have a greater pressure gradient between the Azores and Iceland, so it tends to be high pressure over the Azores, low pressure over Iceland is when you have this strong pressure gradient, then you tend to have low pressure over Greenland. It's not always true, but there is a reasonably strong correlation between, Greenland blocking and the North Atlantic Oscillation. So positive NAO, or a strong NAO, you tend to have low pressure over Greenland. A low NAO, you have the opposite with high pressure or blocking conditions over Greenland.
Okay, now, given that that is an oscillation, how fast has the atmospheric system over Greenland changed? And are we sure it will not, as President Trump said recently about climate change, that it will not change back?
Well, we're not sure. That's a point that we do make in our study. So I always think that it's good to use the observational data as a baseline. So I have actually, with my team, we've constructed a estimate of blocking changes over Greenland for the last 170 years or so. And from those data, which are based largely on observations, it's something called reanalysis data, which is very widely used by climate scientists. It's basically a gridded product based on observations, that certainly the changes in the last 10 to 20 years or up to 30 years in summer are unique in the last 170 years. So we've had record values of Greenland blocking, and those changes have been comparatively rapid in the last 10, 20 years or so, although there are also year-to-year quite large variations as well. So actually 2013, well, we had a record Greenland blocking in 2012, and then a year later in summer also in 2013, actually it went the other way. So there are variations of different timescales, but the trends seem to be quite unique in the last few decades. We're not sure that it won't change back. We need to understand more about the climate system at the Greenland regional scale. But you would kind of expect that as conditions warm over Greenland, all other things being equal, then warmer air masses tend to be linked with higher pressure air masses as well. So with all the changes going on around the ice sheet in Greenland, also, as you mentioned, loss of sea ice around the edges of Greenland, that you would also, that there are good physical reasons for expecting air pressure on average, not all the time, but on average to increase over Greenland.
So you've done classic science in this paper, comparing model predictions to measured reality. Should we trust climate modeling less, or does your work point to the need to keep refining those models?
Well, I think it's kind of a bit of both, but I would emphasize the latter. So we do need to keep working on the models, which, as I said before, they work pretty well at the global or even at the continent scale, but are less reliable once you go to sub-regions or the subcontinental scale. So I think it does highlight a potentially serious issue with models at the regional level over the North Atlantic region over Greenland, which, as I said, is linked at times with extreme weather conditions further south.
Well, right. Governments and corporations need scientific advice to help plan future spending and energy and development. They may not heed that advice, but they do need it. So if our models are still unable to grasp real changes in the climate, do we have other viable alternatives?
I don't think so. I think we need to keep trying to refine the models and also just to link together what the observations are showing with what the models are showing. So I think it's also the way science works is bringing different sub-communities of scientists together a bit more to discuss data sets and models, which is being done more than it used to be, but I think there could be even still a bit more of that. So basically, models are the way forward. We need to keep using them and finding areas where they work less well and then refining them.
The UK has been widely known as the rainy kingdom, but in the 2000s, as you mentioned, there have been some sunny heat waves and even drought in parts of the country. Surprising stuff. Does your research warn North Europeans of wetter weather to come, or do you just say it's possible?
Well, I think it's a distinct possibility. We cannot say for sure, of course. We're not in the directly doing seasonal prediction here, although we're working on that separately. I mean, certainly the UK is known as a nation of huge variations in weather. I mean, it's obviously quite world famous for that. But I'd just like to point out that although we have had these record, 2003, obviously record heat wave over Europe, also 2006, somewhat lesser heat wave, and this year, 2018, we've also had these two record wet summers as well, 2007 and 2012 that you mentioned earlier. So there's been huge variation at both ends of the spectrum, near record years in the context of the last century or so. And while we get variation, it's really interesting to and important to understand some of these processes, such as over Greenland, because they can potentially increase that variation and give us even more extremes. And all the time, remember, there's an undercurrent of increasing average temperature, so it can make the warm years when we get them obviously much more exceptional statistically. But also with these changes over Greenland that I've mentioned, there's also the distinct likelihood that we might get more of these record wet summers as well.
As an aside, I recently read in the Atlantic magazine an article about a period around 230 million years ago called the Carnian Pluvial Episode. And essentially, as I understand it, when the climate warmed between 5 and 7 degrees C, it rained over the Earth for about a million years. And we're starting out possibly to warm that much, maybe not this century, but in the next couple of centuries. Nobody's predicting that as an outcome of our current warming. But does your research, doesn't it kind of say we can't be sure what is going to really happen with this planetary experiment? Your thoughts, Edward?
Well, I mean, the interesting point is we're doing an experiment to the planet that's not exactly the same as what's happened in the past, according to our best understanding. So we're kind of a bit in uncharted territory. So I totally agree that it's very useful to have a look at some of these past climate episodes, even though we probably don't understand that much about some of them, especially these ones that happened so many, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago. But we're doing an experiment where we're very rapidly increasing greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, and that is likely to have some consequences in terms of extreme weather events that we don't yet properly understand, because, as I say, the models are not always perfectly working at the regional scale, and yet there's regions such as the UK, but many other regions that are very highly sensitive to even tiny shifts in the jet stream give you completely opposite conditions in the summer. So, I mean, I really think we're kind of in uncharted territory. And also to note that the 5 to 7 degrees that you mentioned, well, they're model projections that have the Arctic warming more than that in the rest of this century. So you are causing some destabilizations potentially in surface climates over large regions, resulting from very rapid changes in the short periods of time. So I think it's quite interesting in looking at the effects on rainfall and hydrological regimes, as well as just temperature. And of course, we've already discussed some of those recent extremes, which could possibly be enhanced going in over the next few decades.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about?
Basically, I'm really interested in, with my team and other collaborators and so on, looking at the links between climate change generally and extreme weather events across a range of timescales. Because as I said before, climate change is linked with the local weather conditions that people experience. But traditionally, some of the way that we've analysed the climate data, we've compartmentalised timescales, so we've not always linked across what people are actually experiencing on the ground. I think doing more of that is really important. And also, what happens in the Arctic, as you mentioned Jennifer Francis earlier, I think she's been quoted as saying it doesn't always stay in the Arctic, can affect latitudes further south. So I really do think that there's a whole lot that we can look at in terms of deciphering some of these key issues. Lots to keep us busy anyway.
It's odd that the greatest warming is happening in a place where hardly any humans live, and so we don't really report about it, and that is the Arctic.
Absolutely, yes. And yet it's a critically important region in terms of both weather patterns further south, quite likely, I believe, but also obviously directly in terms of sea level rise from response to the ice sheets. And as you've also mentioned, changes in the sea ice as well. I mean, if you're removing all that sea ice, as has happened from the Arctic in the last few decades or so, you're fundamentally changing the amount of energy, increasing the amount of energy absorbed by the oceans. So there's lots of what we call feedback effects that are enhancing rapid warming over the Arctic, which is obviously quite scary on the one hand, but it's also really interesting to study and try and understand on the other.
From Lincoln, UK, we've been talking with Dr. Edward Hanna. He is Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology at the University of Lincoln. We've been talking about a paper titled Brief Communication, Recent Changes in Summer Greenland Blocking Captured by None of the CMIP5 Models. That was published October 16, 2018, by the Cryosphere, and that's a journal from the European Geosciences Union. The critical research comes from Hanna and Dr. Richard Hall at Lincoln with help from the University of Liège. This paper is free to the public, and you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward Hanna, thank you so much for joining us again here on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Famous American scientist Michael Mann is coming up, plus interviews with lead scientists on alarming news. There is way more heat in the ocean than anyone thought possible. Along the way, we discover why all the computing power behind Bitcoin can, all by itself, take us to the 2-degree danger zone. When scientists are on edge, they talk directly and fully to you on Radio EcoShock. For links to follow up on this program, check out my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.